Hello and welcome to Inside Education. We're online at insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
I'm already starting to see, you know, history tests are beginning to pick up, especially on those deeper history questions. I've started to see that when I test them at the end of a month or the end of 3 weeks or so when I have a new unit done, that the scores are starting to improve based on last year's results.
Our reporter Sinead Burke finds out about how one teacher has improved his students' test results since he started using Twitter in the classroom to teach English and history. But first, I bring you the second part of my interview with Dr. Ed Walsh, former president of the University of Limerick, to mark the publication of his book, Upstart: Friends, Foes and Founding a University. On last week's programme, we heard about the changes that Ed Walsh would like to see in primary and post-primary education. This week, we find out more about his role in founding the National Institute of Higher Education, or NIHE, in Limerick, which later became the University of Limerick. When Ed Walsh graduated from University College Cork, he travelled to the United States and enrolled in Iowa State University. He was following in the footsteps of his uncle, who had attended Iowa State some years beforehand and had a strong influence on his nephew.
A man who influenced me a lot. He really applied the principle of serving the community, because he dedicated his research in bacteriology to cleaning up dirty Irish milk. And he was involved in training creamery managers who went all over the country. They'd have known a Mickey Grimes, most creamery managers in the 50s and 60s. So that man was a considerable influence on me, and indeed I ended up going out to the same university where he got his doctorate, and I enrolled in nuclear engineering at a time when nuclear engineering was very much in topic. The Russians were sending nuclear missiles to Cuba. Admiral Rickover was in the process of creating a nuclear navy, and when I got to Iowa, I found myself catapulted from a backwater into what appeared to the middle of a nuclear crisis. And so I studied for nuclear engineering along with a whole lot of military people who were doing likewise. And it was greatly exciting. And then I went on and became, I was invited to become, at age 24, assistant professor at the university. The youngest, I was told there. And then I went on to Virginia Tech, another high-tech university in the States, where I was a director of an energy research laboratory. And then I got married to Stephanie Barrett. Her dad was Fine Gael TD in Cork. And by the time we had two children, we had a decision to make. Did we?
And she was living in the States at the time, is that right?
No, she wasn't. No, I conducted my courtship for many years by letter. I used to write to her every day, and she would write to me before mobile phones. And then she came out and joined me towards the end of the 60s. And when the kids were a couple of years, we had the decision most people do when they're abroad. Do you settle down and you go home? And we opted for going home, and I suppose abandoning all of the work I had put into the whole nuclear and energy area. And we applied for anything that might have me. It turned out I applied for the Limerick undertaking, which I knew very little about.
And apart from having been a student in UCC and then going on to Iowa State, what experiences in your life up to that point had prepared you to be the president of what was the NIHE and what became the University of Limerick?
Probably a very good question. And the good citizens of Limerick, when they found this young lad appointed to head up the project, were asking the very same question. What was this young 29-year-old about? And goodness knows, what was a degree in nuclear engineering and a doctorate related to electron physics going to do? But when I was in the States, I was in fact fundraising, because to run a research laboratory, you need funds. And I managed to convince most of the power companies down the East Coast of the United States to give me a small percentage of their turnover. And I had a strong flow of funding into the research program, and in fact more money than I knew what to do with. So that kind of gave me an experience of talking to the academic community and being part of it. but interacting very much with the business community and realizing that if a university really is going to succeed, it has to be recognized by the taxpayers and those who pay for it, that it's contributing to the well-being of the community. So I think that probably that experience prepared me to create a new kind of institution in Ireland, one that was outward-looking. The established traditional universities did their work as best they could as academics, but there were very few contacts with the community, especially with the community of enterprise. Whereas most of my time in the States, I was interacting with the academic community and the enterprise community. And, you know, goodness knows, there was a huge amount of emigration and poverty and so on, and it was quite clear that the government wanted to make a fresh start. And this was a marvelous opportunity outside of the traditional university system to really start afresh and bring in systems that certainly rock the boat. And
what kind of systems did you bring in that you think had the most far-reaching effect in terms of being innovative at the time?
Yeah, well, the academic system I introduced was the cooperative education, where you expected all students to interleave practice and theory. And we were sending out our students for 2 6-month periods during the four-year degree program, and they were being paid at the regular rates. And then they did their senior year project on an experience, real live problem experience they were having in the world of work, whether it was as European studies students in maybe the airport in Paris, engineers with some of the new Westinghouse and GE companies that were coming in, business people dealing with industrial relations problems. So before we produced our first graduates, a gentleman came into my office, Ray Stata, the chairman of Analog Devices, and he says, look, I've heard about you importing the US approach to university work, and my colleagues have said, look, Ireland isn't sufficiently developed. I want to manufacture silicon chips in Europe. So we responded, in fact, to him by changing the content of 2 degree programs to meet his needs. And he came into Limerick, established Analog Devices, and had manufactured silicon chips in 1976. And the yield in Limerick and the efficiency in Limerick was higher than the mother plant in Boston. And the industrialists in the United States couldn't believe it. So we had a succession of new industries, Wang and Digital and Westinghouse and so on, coming through, seeing the new laboratories that had been established, seeing the students.
So you really think that those, say the likes of Dell even later, that they wouldn't have come along had it not been for UL and NIHE at the time?
Well, certainly the first series of industries that came in selectively into the Shannon region, and at one time in the late 70s, a quarter of all of Irish exports were coming out of the Shannon region. So absolute certainty that this acted as a catalyst, and the Industrial Development Authority and Shannon Development just brought these industrialists along to, one, see what we were doing academically, and the World Bank. We had managed to secure funding for a remarkable 50 laboratories equipped with the world's latest equipment. And then they went on to see some of the industries, see the graduates running them. And it was kind of a no-brainer for them. In those days, American companies were getting a return of some 25% return on capital invested. So that was the kind of the academic component, and I took the view that all knowledge is good, but certain areas of knowledge are of more importance to a community when they relate to the strength of that community, to the needs of that community. So we focused on the needs of the day. There was a shortage of, we were joining Europe, there was a shortage of European studies people, so the first degree in European studies was created for an arts degree. There was a shortage of business people who could go out internationally and speak French, German, or Russian and do marketing. There was a shortage of electronic engineers. There was a shortage of manufacturing engineers, smart manufacturing. There was a shortage of materials, advanced materials scientists. There was a shortage of industrial designers. So we just focused on the areas.
And it was very much, it sounds like, that you were preparing for specific professions rather than, say, a more broad-based arts education or science education?
Well, that might be the perception, but I took the view. C.P. Snow had written his book the two cultures, where he highlighted that the Victorians separated the areas of knowledge one from the other. And my view was that we should get back to the kind of Renaissance idea where an educated person was someone who had a broad base. And I took the view that the scientists and engineers should have an exposure to the arts and humanities, because their work, their inventions, of course, had to be directed to the needs of society. Even more so, I felt that those who studied the arts and humanities should be scientifically literate, because they had a function in a scientific age. So we put a lot of effort into this interdisciplinary work, requiring scientists and engineers to take courses in the humanities and vice versa. Now, we could do this because what we introduced from the United States was the modular system. You know, previously the courses just ran for a year and someone lectured and droned on, and the students in the traditional universities became very energetic and swatted up during the last couple of weeks of the year. We introduced a system for every 12 weeks we had tests and a continuous assessment with the modular system and the semester system. Now, everyone else is doing it, but at the time no one was doing it until we introduced it.
Right.
And I also took the view that academics, especially in science and engineering, shouldn't be lecturing on those topics unless they themselves had practiced as engineers and scientists in the world of work. And when we went to recruit our scientists and engineers, we had many applications from the traditional universities, and we refused to appoint them because most of them had no practical experience.
So was that the primary thing you were looking for when you were recruiting lecturers, that they had experience in the world of work in the area they were going to be instructing in?
Yes, of course. I mean, in medicine, the universities would see it as unreasonable to recruit medical doctors who had never seen a patient.
Yeah,
but that wasn't the case in science and engineering and business. So we insisted that, as well as being well qualified, that the people we selected would have a lot of practical experience, which meant that very few Irish academics were appointed in the first phase. And most of our people came in from the UK, from the US, and from continental Europe. That wasn't appreciated by the traditional academics, the idea that they would apply for a post in this new whippersnapper institution in Limerick and be rejected. So we built up a whole lot of hostility. And I asked the senior person, Assistant Secretary Sean O'Connor in the department. I said, "Sean, I want you to help me." And he said, "What do you want me to do?" I said, "I want a minute of your time every day." "What do you mean?" I said, "I want to meet with you once a month for 30 minutes. So I met with the key person in the Department of Education once a month, and normally the 30 minutes became most of the morning. And in fact, he saw the initiative in Limerick as a means of stimulating the whole university system, because we won, after being assessed by the World Bank, we got their agreement to support the first phase of development. And buildings were coming up out of the ground, the latest laboratories equipped with the world's best equipment, while the established universities had old-fashioned laboratories and ancient equipment. And the message went out, rather not very subtly, I suppose, that once you start responding to the needs of the new industrializing Ireland, Cork and Galway and UCD and Trinity will also receive funding. So we were used, I suppose, as a stalking horse by the Department of Education, and that too built up huge animosity towards us.
And that was Ed Walsh, former president of University of Limerick. His book, Upstart, Friends, Foes and Founding University, is published by Collins Press and is available from Easons for €28. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, insideed.com. Next this week, we look at educational applications of Twitter. Inside Education reporter Sinead Burke spoke to Fintan O'Mahony about how he uses Twitter in the classroom. Fintan, who is known to Twitter users as Lev Davidovich, is a post-primary teacher of English and History. He described to Sinead how he uses Twitter in his class, and he also talks about a Twitter network called EdChat.ie, which promotes collegiality among teachers by providing a forum for discussion and debate among those interested in education in Ireland. Sinead first asked Fintan how he uses Twitter in the classroom.
What I've done, Sinead, is I've set up two Twitter accounts, one for my history class and one for my English class. And I use them as much as I can for, in history class, people in history questions, getting timelines right, tweeting about, you know, current events and historical events. And in my English class then, we use it for creative writing. We've used it for example, in reading a novel we did, To Kill a Mockingbird, and we were tweeting from the courtroom during the reading of the novel. So I tried to think of as many creative ways of using it as possible that will keep the kids interested, and so that they won't switch off too quickly and they'll be interested to use it another day again.
You mentioned people in history questions there. Are there any other educational advantages of Twitter?
There are, in that one of the things that I do is that I have a data projector, so I project all the tweets up onto the whiteboard. All the girls have their mobile phones or have laptops out. So if they, in their group, send a tweet to the board and it isn't spelled right or they don't take credit for it, they don't have their initials on it, I delete it straight away. Now, if I do that, they'll usually go mad. But the advantage of it is that there's an accuracy in their tweets that they might not have in their homework, and there's an accuracy in their tweets that they know they're going to be published. And recently what I've started to do is I started creating tweet docs. Tweetdocs.com collects tweets, so I can print off a copy of the 20 or so tweets we might get out of a class, and I can give them to students who are going home and might not have internet connections at home. So there's those advantages as well as the fun of it, and as well as the interest that they might have in using technology in the classroom.
And you mentioned there that if the tweet is spelt incorrectly or if there's grammatical mistakes, but in Twitter there is a limited number of characters which the students can use, and abbreviated text is sometimes used then. Do you not include that, or what would you do if something has to go
I wouldn't allow, I would allow them to abbreviate some words, but one of the rules you have is that you have to include the hashtag that we're using. So the other day, for example, we were doing tweets on the Reformation in Ireland and England, so our hashtag was #reform, IRE, or ENGIRE. So that had to be included. Then whoever was in the group had to have their initials at the end of the tweet. So those spaces are already taken up. So they have only a limited amount of time. So you find sometimes that the girls have to edit down what they want to say into a fairly manageable space. And that's very, very handy for junior cert history, because in junior cert history, the junior cert curriculum talks about significant relevant statements. So a tweet, to me, in that class is a significant relevant statement. And if I print those off for them, or they collect them themselves at home by making favourites out of them, they can use those to build a question at home. They can use those to build their answer at home. And that, you know, that fulfills an essential part of their history education, because, you know, like I said, it's in the curriculum, and they are editing all the time. And the better editors they are, the better they're going to be able to perform in class, and the better they're able to gather the information quickly.
You were saying there about the statements and their own information and the kind of what they have learned, but would you ever use Twitter, I suppose, to communicate with the outside world, perhaps a topic they are studying in English, the author,
What I would do with them is that we're following a fairly limited number of people now. We're not kind of onto the stage where the class is following too many accounts, but I know that my students now, a lot of them have set up Twitter accounts, and they're following a lot of, you know, they're following a lot of accounts themselves. Now, you know, it's hard to get 14 or 15 year olds interested in following stuff that's very educational, if you know what I mean, that they want to follow something that's going to have something that's of interest to them in it. But, you know, for example, now I'll be putting a link to that. There was a supplement in the Irish Times at the weekend about young teenagers writing. I'll be putting a link to that on the Twitter account for my English class. So, you know, there are things like that I would link to, that I would expect them to read, but they might not be going looking for that stuff themselves just yet. You know, they kind of still rely on me to do a certain amount of the work, which is okay, because, I mean, you know, I'm obviously going to find that stuff an awful lot more easier than they are.
Some teachers are quite weary of technology and perhaps giving children open access to the internet.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to these teachers on using Twitter in their classrooms?
I kind of had, it came to me like as a brainwave, really, in August. I was using Twitter myself for about 8 or 10 months. I was using it for that length of time. And over the summer, I started developing, even though it was the summertime, I started developing a kind of a network of people that I was following and were following me. And, you know, I started using it for my own benefit. And then I thought, well, maybe I could use this in a classroom. And we had just had a technology grant in school, and we were all going to get a laptop for the teacher. We were all getting new data projectors. So I thought, well, if I'm going to have this data projector and I'm going to have this laptop, why don't I, you know, use it in a class. And then we had always had a problem in school with students bringing their mobile phones to class. So I thought, well, if we flip that over and we allow them to bring their mobile phones and allow them to use them for something, we might get an awful lot more of an engagement out of them. So I went to the staff room at our first staff meeting in August, and I asked the staff to kind of have faith in me that would they be allowed to bring their mobile phones to class. And we, gratefully, they changed the rules so the students could carry their mobile phones around. Previously, they weren't allowed to have their mobile phones on them at all. So now our students are allowed to carry their mobile phones around, and if I want to use them in class, they have them. I have a couple of spare old laptops of kind of pirated out of a few different places in the school so that I'm able to use those as well. And, you know, I have maybe 10 or 12 handsets or laptops available at any time in the classroom. So there's always a group of two or three that are gathered around something. That kind of helps them coordinate as well. I try to form the groups around a student who'll be very tech-savvy, a student who'll be very, you know, savvy about what's going on in the class, and then a third student who might not have those skills, so that the three of them are learning something and three of them are grouped together in a group that will work. So those are that you really have to have the support of the staff. You really need to have an interest in it yourself before you go in. You need to dip your toe in the water a little bit so you're not kind of jumping in the deep end. And, you know, just take it slowly from there. I mean, and then you've really got to, all you've got to do then is start thinking of applications, you know. The people in history idea came to me in a flash, using it for the classroom, for the courtroom in To Kill a Mockingbird. That was something I thought of on a Monday, and on Wednesday I was doing it. You know, you really just have to go with your instincts sometimes, and it's really enhanced the way that I do things. It hasn't changed the stuff that I do, but I just have another tool that I can do things, another method I can use to do things. So I'm not just using a photocopy. I'm not just writing on the board. I'm using Twitter as well as those things, and that's really kind of engaging the students. Like I always say to people, you have to, students are all there. They all know about the internet. They're all on Facebook for an hour and a half every evening. So if they're there, we teachers have to go there too. We have to go and find where they are so that we can engage with them. And if we do that, you know, I think we'll get an awful lot more mileage out of them. I'm already starting to see, you know, history tests are beginning to pick up, especially on those deep in history questions. I've started to see that when I test them at the end of a month or the end of 3 weeks or so, when I have a new unit done, that the scores are starting to improve based on last year's results. So, you know, if the results are there, if it's improving their recall on a history test, that's proof enough in the pudding for me.
Students, I suppose, already have the grounding in educational technology and technology in Twitter and Facebook, so use it to your advantage.
Yeah, I mean, not a huge number, but a lot of students would have had Twitter accounts beforehand. Mm-hmm. And I find it interesting that my fifth and sixth years, my Leaving Cert students, are not as keen on this as my Junior Cert students are. I have second and third year students in English and history, and they come in every morning and say, "When are we going to use our phones today, sir?" Whereas my fifth and sixth years are not so keen. I think that might be because they're an awful lot more exam focused, and they're kind of worrying that if we spend time having fun using Twitter or we're doing it that way, that we're not going to get any credit for that when we do our Leaving Cert. And that's something I have to get over yet, but I'm kind of slowly trying to break down that wall. But it's much, much easier with the younger kids. And I think that might be just where it is. Twitter particularly might be just something that 12 and 14-year-olds are into that 17, 18-year-olds aren't yet, you know?
Very much so. And Twitter offers a platform, I suppose, not just for Irish students, but teachers as well. And in my experience, Irish teachers are becoming much more discursive online through the hashtag EdChat.ie.
Absolutely, yeah.
Could you explain just a little bit about this, please?
EdChat.ie was set up by a man who works for the NCTE called Fred Boff. And it's the tool that really got me interested in not just tweeting for entertainment purposes, actually using it for, you know, for professionally, really. On a Monday night, having picked a topic over the weekend, we start up at 8:30 on a Monday night. We spend an hour then talking about a particular topic, and, you know, people can just watch what's going on. They can watch the tweets coming in. They can get involved. They can get engaged. Recently, we had some very interesting ones about, say, for example, now Junior Cert reform. You know, we had one recently there about what could I pass on to newly qualified teachers? What have I learned from my teaching experience myself? So, you know, we're currently voting on what tomorrow night's one is going to be. So that has been a huge advantage to me. And if I ever find anything on Twitter that I think that anybody on HIE would be interested in, I'll put that hashtag on the end of the tweet. And then people can read it and they can see what's going on. And, you know, that really kind of opened my eyes to the professional, like I said earlier on, the professional advantage to it. You could be sitting at home in the evening, you could see a television program coming on, you could just let people know that it's on. You know, I could be reading an article in a magazine about online in something to do with history, and I could put tweet about it, link to it, and tweet to it. So that's been a huge change and a huge advantage to me, because, you know, not only are you spreading that information, but the amount of feedback you get from people then, and the connections you make with people are just fantastic. And, you know, it's all very positive stuff. I mean, a lot of, you know, I'm as bad as anybody else. I'm often tweeting on a Friday night during the Late Late Show about how awful it is. But at the same time, EdChat is just, it's all also positive, and it's also, you know, collegiate is the word I'd use. We're all working at the same goal. We all want to make our teaching experience better, and that's really what it's all about. And if we can do that, then using that, well, you know, I think it's fantastic.
Having interacted with that hashtag myself, I can just see it's an extremely supportive network.
Exactly, yeah. And you know, if you need something, if you need to get a particular piece of information, or if you're looking for something, you know, you can just send a message out. Sometimes you'll get a slow response, but after a while, you know, people, after retweeting and sending it on to their followers, you'll eventually get a response about something or other. You know, the network of people is just fantastic. And like I said, they're all very positive about education. So it's not always about griping, and it's not always about giving out. And it's nice to have a place where that goes on, because, you know, I know that in many staff rooms around the country, a lot of people might be cross and might be giving out about various things. But when you're on EdChat, i.e., you get kind of a sense that it's all very positive, and that, you know, while we might have our gripes, we might have our arguments, we might have our rows with whoever's in charge, at the same time, you know, we're all professionals, and that hashtag really gives us an opportunity, like I said, to get information and to share information. I just think that's fantastic.
And you mentioned earlier that people can either spectate the chat or become involved themselves.
Yeah.
How can they do either?
Well, if you're using Twitter already, really all you've got to do is to make sure that you do a search for hashtag EdChat.ie. If you have something like TweetDeck on your laptop, you can set up a column so that you can see all the tweets coming in a feed straight away. But you can, you know, you can lurk, as we call it. You can just watch what people are talking about, and then maybe something that somebody says might spark an interest that you have, and you can respond to that. But the other way to do it then is to get involved in it from the start. You know that we start at 8:30. You're there at 8:30. You know, introduce yourself, you listen to what other people are saying, and you respond to what they're saying. And, you know, that means that you're going to find people who are interested in the same line of thinking as you are. You're going to find people who are interested in the same ideas as you are. And you'll probably find people who disagree with you as well. But, I mean, you know, that's very healthy as well. Whichever way you handle it, whether you're just lurking around and having a look at what people are talking about, or whether you're fully engaged in it, it's been a huge advantage to me.
I probably shouldn't admit this, but I was lurking on EdChat.ie a couple of weeks ago, and the topic that was under discussion was just enthralling, I suppose is the word I could say, but the topic was the most important lessons I've learned in education.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And I had a look through your blog, and you wrote a really impressive article about this. Would you be able to just give the listeners an insight into what's some of your lessons that you've learned?
Oh, God, I can't remember. I started off trying to be funny about that, it has to be said. I mean, you know, because some people were being very serious and were saying, you know, the things that they've learned and were passing on all kinds of very erudite information. Whereas I said, the most important thing to do in a staff room is to make the tea regularly. You know, that if you want to get on with your colleagues, the second thing then was make friends with the people in the office. And you know, if you're friends with the secretary, you'll go far. But then I kind of started thinking, and I started adding other ones to it. And you know, other ones that were kind of only half in jest, always play the DVD before you turn it on. You know, if you're showing a DVD to a group, make sure you watch the clip that you're going to show before you turn it on. And I actually was laughing because 2 days later I turned on Casablanca. I was doing my leaving certs in English, and I hadn't set the DVD up. I just kind of pressed play from the previous day, and of course the DVD didn't work, and I spent 5 minutes footing around trying to fix it. But yeah, that was a fantastic discussion, because some of us were kind of being funny about it, some of us were being serious about it, some people were passing on genuine, you know, links to interesting information about how to improve your teaching. And then, you know, I was, like I said, some of us were being more kind of more funny about the whole thing, and at least trying to be funny about the whole thing. But yeah, I did. I put them all together in a list, and Fred Boss was joking that would I make it to 20 tweets. So I actually did. I did get the 20 things that I've learned. Although I have to say, some of them were purely in jest.
And that was Fintan O'Mahony, a.k.a. Lev Davidovich, on Twitter, speaking to Inside Education reporter Sinead Burke. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on InsideEd.com or on iTunes. You can email us at InsideEducation@DublinCityFM.ie. Thanks to our guests this week, Ed Walsh and Fintan O'Mahony, and to my colleague Sinead Burke. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.